The government now concedes that the district court's stated ground for denying Mr. Brown's habeas petition was incorrect. The government acknowledges that there is no categorical bar to challenging a sentence under 28 U.S.C. section 2241. And the government also concedes that, based on this court's decision in Narvaez, the erroneous application of the mandatory career offender guideline is the sort of fundamental error that merits relief under section 28 U.S.C. section 2241. So given the government's concessions in its brief, I'll focus my presentation on the issue that's primarily litigated between the parties, which is whether or not reckless arson under Delaware law qualifies as a crime of violence within the meaning of the career offender guideline. We respectfully submit to the court it does not. There's really two issues here, one of which is whether it qualifies as, quote, generic arson, and the other is whether it falls under the residual clause of the career offender guideline, which is substantively identical to the residual clause.
What would be an example of a case in Delaware case law that would show that this third degree arson is not a crime of violence?
Well, Your Honor, there's very little case law in Delaware about this particular offense. The statutory maximum is 2 years. There's more case law about sort of more serious forms of arson, and so I think that one just would look at the elements of this particular offense, which, as we explained, require.
But the Delaware courts have never construed the.
Well,
you say there's very little case law. I'm just interested in whether there are any Delaware cases like this one.
There are a few Delaware cases sort of involving offenses under that statute, but they don't. I mean, I don't think that there's a disputed issue of statutory construction involving this statute. The element is quite clear that intent is required in setting the fire, but recklessness is the only mens rea requirement with respect to the causation of damage.
How are the first degree and second degree crimes defined in the statute?
The second degree arson has the intentional setting of the fire and, I believe, the intentional causation of damage, or perhaps known causation of damage to a building. First degree, I believe it requires physical injury, but I don't remember the exact elements of the offense. I think it requires physical injury to a person, but I don't recall the specific elements of that offense. But, you know, this...
But the problem is, recklessness, of course, can be a basis for very severe criminal punishment. You know, reckless homicide, for example.
That's true, Your Honor. But first of all, in Delaware, it evidently isn't. It's a 2-year statutory maximum. It's labeled a nonviolent felony, as we explained in our brief, by the Delaware Sentencing Commission. And, you know, we list some other offenses in Delaware that are equivalently Class G felonies, like, you know, failure to register before telemarketing or failure to accurately label certain music records, sort of non-serious types of crimes. And moreover, in Woods, this court did hold that involuntary manslaughter involving recklessness mens rea was not a crime of violence, at least under the residual clause. So we think that this is a considerably less serious offense than that, as understood in Delaware.
Well, we were, of course, interpreting and applying the Begay case in Woods, which required, for purposes of a residual clause case, a finding that the conduct that's covered by the statute in question is purposeful, violent, or aggressive. And the government argues that requirement should no longer be strictly construed as a requirement in light of the Sykes opinion from the Supreme Court, no relation.
I'm glad to hear that, Your Honor.
And, I mean, that's the crux of the residual clause issue here, is whether we need to pull back from our decision in Woods, sort of compartmentalizing crimes as included or excluded based on the mens rea of purposefulness or intent, as opposed to recklessness in light of the Sykes case.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, we don't think the court should take that step for a couple of reasons. First of all, of course, Sykes was an affirmance of this court's opinion, and in the Sykes opinion issued by this court, the court distinguished Woods, so I think it's hard to say that in that respect. And there are post-Sykes opinions applying that very standard. In the Brown versus Rios case, this court applied the purposeful, violent, and aggressive framework. And there's a there's a career offender case from this court we cite in our brief that specifically says that Woods remains good law, and that's post Sykes. Sykes versus the United States, that is. And so we respectfully submit that this court's case law supports the view, at least, that even after Sykes, Begay remains good law. And as we explained in our brief, we think that Sykes is distinguishable from this case in several different respects.
Yeah, I don't mean to suggest that Begay is not good law anymore, but the Sykes opinion did say that the purposeful, violent, and aggressive language in Begay was merely descriptive of the conduct in question and nothing more, and that at least arguably calls into question whether we should be applying it as a strict requirement here. It's a little hard to sort of follow the moves in the Supreme Court's residual clause jurisprudence, but that's the question in this case anyway.
I certainly won't disagree with that, Your Honor, having read these cases. They are somewhat difficult to reconcile, but I do think they are reconciled, as we explained in our brief. In Sykes, the court did not overrule Begay, and the court said that Begay was akin to a recklessness offense. And I think that in this particular case, when the only intentional act is just setting a fire, you could be setting a cigarette, a bonfire, you know, in a fireplace, anything like that, viewing that act in isolation, one would not ordinarily consider that to be a violent action. And what really gives this offense its legs is the recklessness, and we think that that is exactly what the court meant by recklessness offenses in Begay. And, you know, in this court's opinion in Clinton, which we quote in our reply brief, the court characterized Woods this way. Woods as holding that, quote, where a statute codifies an act's consequences as an element of the offense, sentencing enhancement requires a finding that the defendant intended both the act and its consequences. That's how the court explained what Woods held in this court's opinion in Clinton. And under that rule, I think that this cannot qualify as a crime of violence because the act's consequences are in the offense and there's an explicit recklessness mens rea. And we don't think that Sykes overruled or limited this court's prior jurisprudence in that area, especially since that in Sykes itself, in this court, distinguished Woods and viewed that there is a fundamental difference between the Begay framework and the particular offense there, which was fleeing and eluding a police officer. So the panel has no further questions. I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Unikowski. Mr. Rotker?
May it please the court, good morning. Michael Rotker from the Department of Justice on behalf of the respondent, Warden John Carraway. Much of the discussion this morning, if one was a casual observer of this case, one might think that this was actually a direct appeal from a final judgment of conviction. This is not a direct appeal. It's not even an initial collateral attack. This is a successive collateral attack on a judgment that became final nearly 15 years ago. And as we've argued in our brief, Your Honor, successive relief is really reserved.
It doesn't sound like arson to me.
I believe it is arson, Your Honor, or at least...
I don't understand that. Some idiot sets a fire in his fireplace, and he knows the flue is defective.
Right.
But he says, take a chance, and so on, and burns down his house.
Right.
That doesn't sound like arson.
Well,
arson is a very sinister crime. It's usually punished very, very heavily. Because it's so dangerous and because it is deliberate, and Delaware just has decided to call something arson,
right?
Which is like, and it's very much like reckless driving, right? Reckless driving is dangerous,
right?
But it's not dangerous in the same way that reckless homicide is, and I just don't think this is arson. Because we're not dealing with the residual clause. We're trying to figure out what arson means in the statute. Do other states have had call this kind of conduct arson?
Your Honor, there are cases that are cited in the brief. I believe there's an Eighth Circuit decision involving a Missouri statute that prescribes knowingly burning. I confess that I always forget on the tail end whether it's intending to cause consequences or with reckless disregard, but knowingly burning statutes have been classified, Whaley is the Eighth Circuit case that I'm talking about, that it encompasses, substantially corresponds, if you will, to the generic understanding of arson. So there are statutes out there.
Well, what do you mean it corresponds to generic understanding?
As in Taylor, for example.
Well, how many states have a law like Delaware?
I don't know off the top of my head, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that important? You're talking about generic understanding. Suppose two states have laws like this, and all the rest, they may punish reckless fire setting,
right,
firecrackers and all this stuff,
right,
but that doesn't mean they call it arson.
No, Your Honor, but what I think, I don't know how many states punish this particular type.
You should know.
Well, respectfully, I should. That's right. But the way the case has come up now, Your Honor, it's the burden has been on the defendant as a successive collateral petitioner. He has to prove that this doesn't qualify as arson. Now, his argument is based on this idea that arson requires a purpose to inflict injury. And what we have pointed out and what is before the court is that Professor Lefebvre...
Well, how does Black's Law Dictionary define arson?
I don't have the definition in front of me, Your Honor.
I don't think you've done any work on this case.
I'm sorry that the court feels that way.
We look at the standard law dictionary, see what arson means.
Well, we have looked, for example, at Professor Lefebvre's treatise, who summarizes...
Well, look at Black's Law Dictionary.
Well, I should have, Your Honor, and I apologize for not having done so. I mean, the way we've approached it, and the way we've understood it, and perhaps there's been a conceptual breakdown, I believe it's their burden to come forward and show that they are ineligible.
We're talking about facts. We're talking about interpretation. When we talk about burden of proof, we're talking about evidence. We're not talking about legal arguments.
Well, I think with respect, in some ways we are talking about legal arguments about what the
definition... This is not what people think of as arson. So if somehow the law has taken some strange turn and decided to describe any accident involving a fire as arson, well, it seems to me you have some burden of persuasion.
I appreciate that. I don't believe that what we're trying to say is that any act involving fire. The Delaware statute, as the court was asking my opponent this morning, it prescribes intentionally setting a fire. And we've cited the court to some...
An intentional setting a fire.
Yes.
That's lighting a cigarette, right? So you light a cigarette and you're careless, and you don't look where you throw your cigarette, and it causes some conflagration.
It is, Your Honor, but again, as the court, I'm sure, is aware...
Is that arson?
Probably not, but that's because it's not prosecuted as arson. We look in the ordinary...
You lost me. I don't understand.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Based on James and the...
Stop it with the case. Why isn't that arson? On your view of arson, generic arson.
Well, we don't have... That's sort of the point. Our view is that it's not clear what the elements of generic arson are. That's exactly the point. What we're saying is the Delaware statute prescribes three different tiers of arson. This is the third degree tier. It prescribes an intentional burning...
Look, they're using the word arson. That doesn't mean that that's the concept of arson in the federal statute, which is not tied to the idiosyncrasies of one or two states.
No, but the idiosyncrasy, I think, is that the position that's been advanced is that it's...
I don't understand you. What kind of fire, what kind of deliberate...
Intentionally setting up... I'm sorry. I apologize.
What kind of deliberate lighting of a match with resulting damage is not arson, in your view?
What kind of... I don't, under the Delaware statute, Your Honor, or in general? I think in general that would be arson.
I'm talking about federal statute. I don't mean the Delaware statute.
You mean the guideline, the career offender guideline? I'm sorry, I just want to follow Your Honor's question. In our view, what Your Honor's hypothetical probably would qualify as arson. If you intentionally light something and you, with an intent, with an effort to burn a structure, I think that falls...
No, effort to burn a structure.
If you light
No, that's the intention. That's arson. Yeah, you want to burn a structure. If you just are very careless and you toss a match into what turns out to be a barrel of oil, a barrel of gasoline, and blow up a building,
right?
Is that arson?
No, probably not, because arson is a crime against property. It's generally been understood at the common law as a crime against the property. It's the residence. It's the protection of the dwelling. It's burning down someone's home has been traditionally understood as the crime of arson. It's a property offense.
So if I toss a match carelessly into a barrel of gasoline and it blows up and burns down a building, is that arson?
I think it could be, yes. I think under the Delaware statute, it's certainly broad enough that it would cover arson.
We're not talking about the Delaware statute. We're talking about federal law.
Under federal law, I think that would satisfy generic.
The state can use a word to define anything it wanted.
Right. It's not the label that matters. We agree with that. The court has to look beyond the label.
Why do you keep going back to the Delaware statute?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. The way we had understood this is that he was convicted under a Delaware state statute that prescribed the crime of third-degree arson.
Delaware statute does not prescribe the content of federal law.
No, it does not. But it's certainly the question is whether under Taylor versus United States, the question is whether the state statute substantially corresponds.
What if in Delaware, murder in the 10th degree is killing someone's pet?
Right.
Would you say that was generic murder?
No.
Well, I don't see the difference between that case and this case when you say, well, yes, someone who carelessly tosses a match into a barrel of gasoline and blows up a house, he's not intending to blow up the house, just an idiot. You're saying that's arson.
Well, part of the reason that I feel hamstrung, and maybe this is I've hoisted myself into this situation, is that we have not focused, for purposes of this being a successive collateral attack, the question is whether there's some precedent that the petitioner can point to that demonstrates that his view of arson is correct.
Why do you need a precedent?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why do you need a precedent?
Well, for example, in Davenport, the court
had
begun.
Why do you need a precedent?
Because
there's going to be a first case, right?
Correct.
They're not going to have a precedent.
Well, the case could be, for example, this court could decide this issue on a direct appeal, and then it would have a precedent.
Or
it could
what?
It could decide it on a direct appeal. Then there would be a precedent, just like in.
So you say you can't have a challenge to you can't have a collateral challenge until the. The issue has been resolved in a direct appeal?
My time is up. May I answer Your Honor's question?
Why would I ask you a question if I didn't want it answered?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was just trying to be respectful of the court.
Well,
yes.
I wish people would stop making that asking. When a judge asks a question and the red light goes on, obviously the judge wants an answer.
Certainly, and I'm happy to answer the question. Yes, that is our position. We think that the precedent should be established so that the prisoner who seeks successive collateral relief is relying on an established principle rather than asking the court to announce it in the first instance. That was the circumstance the court confronted in all of its prior savings clause. I don't want to say all, but for example, in Davenport, we had the Bailey rule that made clear that use, passive possession was not use. And in subsequent cases, there has been precedent that has established the legal right that the prisoner is seeking. We're not taking issue, and that's one of the reasons why I have come apparently unprepared today to discuss the nuances of arson, because we believe it's a debatable issue. And if the Supreme Court were to rule, for example, next year or in 2 years, that arson is defined in the way that Mr. Brown says, he would be free to come in and file a 2241 invoking that precedent.
And you are advocating this as a universal rule. There can never be a collateral attack unless there is a precedent?
A successive collateral attack, yes, under 2241. That is the law as it stands right now, for example, for successive 2255s based on new rules of constitutional law. A prisoner couldn't come in before Apprendi, let's say, and say, I want you to adopt Apprendi. He would come in after and try to rely on the Apprendi precedent. Now, it's not retroactive, so that's a separate question, but for purposes of what the rule should be, successive 2255s, we believe, ought to inform how the court.
So you think you think your opponent's argument is just totally irrelevant? It doesn't matter what arson really is, because there's no precedent saying that this particular form of so-called arson is not.
I think I would use the word premature rather than irrelevant. I think, you know, if they have to point to something, they're trying to anchor this in Begay. And for the reasons that were discussed with Judge Sykes before, I think that the Sykes decision at least raises some questions at least. We don't have to go so far as to say Sykes abrogates Begay or even curtails it, but it at least raises some questions of how we do a residual clause analysis today.
This is not a residual clause. This is arson.
It's both, Your Honor. They've argued under both. They have to prove that it's not arson, and they have to prove that it doesn't satisfy the residual clause. If either one is satisfied, then the predicate was properly counted, okay, and the sentencing enhancement is correct.
But as I understand the argument you're making from the podium, which is, I think, a little different from the argument that was in the briefs, it's that the prisoner is not procedurally barred from bringing this challenge, but we can't address the merits, which is kind of a, you know, Hence, well, I win, guilty, lose proposition.
It's an interesting question. I hadn't thought, it's not a procedural barrier per se, although I guess in theory the court could write that and say that in the future, you know, just like in successive 2255s, the prisoner can't even get in the door to file it unless he can rely on the new rule of law, and the court could certainly adopt that as a rule for 2241, that district courts shouldn't entertain.
Where would that rule come from?
You know, from successive, if I may.
It's not statutory. You know, you're asking us to impose it.
Well, I think the way I would answer that is that 2241 law is largely judge-made. It's interpreting inadequate or ineffective. But I think it draws content from the statutory limits on successive 2255s. And so if Congress has seen fit to say successive 2255s are not vehicles for making new law, they're for piggybacking off of a precedent, I think the court could write that as a rule of law for a section 2241 and say, look, the district court considering this savings clause petition, this extraordinary request for relief, that a threshold screening should be, what's the precedent? Does he have a precedent that squarely establishes or at least establishes an entitlement to relief? And if he doesn't, that should be the end of the matter.
So what if the basis for enhancement here was that he had smoked a cigarette in a forbidden area? So he had caused a fire.
Right.
In a forbidden area, because the cigarette was on fire.
Right.
And you would say there'd be no basis for collateral relief because there'd never been a case saying that that wasn't arson.
Again, I just want to be clear. We're only advocating this limitation with respect to successive rounds of collateral relief. I'm sorry, Your Honor's question said collateral relief generally. I want to distinguish first and second. Yes.
No, that would be your position.
Assuming
it doesn't matter how goofy the enhancement had been.
I appreciate,
be as ludicrous as in my... make no difference to your argument.
Well, I think our first line of...
It would make no difference to the argument you've been pushing for
the last 5 minutes.
No, it wouldn't,
but the court could adopt some rule that if it was so, you know, facially transparent, you know, so facially evident that it doesn't qualify, that the state law has already rejected it, for example, perhaps, you know, there could be exceptions on the periphery. I think here, this is sort of right in the middle. I think we have Sykes that has changed the law on the residual clause. Begay, too, is a strict liability crime. And this court's decision in Woods, for example, and Smith, the other cases that were cited, say that Begay doesn't cover offenses that have only a mens rea of recklessness. Now, whatever one can say about the Delaware statute, it doesn't have only a mens rea of recklessness. As we've been discussing, it does have an intent component.
Well, as the law understands mens rea, it does.
Yes, that's right. As the law understands mens rea, it has
recklessness only. Mens rea refers to not just the act, but the act and its consequences.
Well, I think, but here it's both. I mean, it's not silent with respect to the act. It's not saying negligent if you negligently start a fire.
Mens rea is focused on the consequences intended, and that's the recklessness part of the statute.
Well, I think
it's a crime of recklessness.
Okay. I mean, if that's the way the court. I mean, we think it's different. We think it's somewhat in the nature of a hybrid. I mean, it doesn't prescribe, for example, if someone were to be building a home and the electrician crosses the wires by accident and it sparks a fire. That's not intentionally starting a fire.
No, but the electrician is intentionally crossing the wires.
No, I was assuming it was an accident. I mean, we're talking about, you know, what I'm trying to do is say that the statute doesn't purport to cover all fires that start no matter what, no matter how. It's limited to a subset, a conscious, volitional act to start a fire. That's the intentional burning.
And if I could clarify just before
yes.
you sit down,
Absolutely.
Your proposed rule about the prematurity of this claim. So
yes.
prisoner... Extrapolating from the rules about successives under
yes.
2255, the prisoner has to wait until there's a Supreme Court decision addressing his very issue, which may never come.
Right. Well, at a minimum, I think he would have to point to, certainly that would be the best case, a Supreme Court decision, but at least controlling circuit precedent. Now, in 2241...
Maybe a long wait.
Well, it may be, but it's, you know, there is no forbidden, he would be entitled to come back later. There's no second or successive barrier on 2241s. And there have been situations where prisoners have brought the claim, it's been premature, and they're later vindicated. That's what came up in this court's decision, for example, in Morales versus Beezy, which was a Shalaba Santos about proceeds as profits. The prisoner filed his 2241. It was before Santos, the Supreme Court Santos case. Court declined to grant relief, saying it would be premature at that juncture. Then Santos came down, and I can say, because I was involved in the litigation, the prisoner went back and filed another 2241, and the government agreed to relief because he had been convicted of something that wasn't a crime.
Santos was on review at that time?
Santos was, cert had been granted, yes. That's right. But as the court well knows, ACCA cases and career offender cases are before the court all the time. There's one right now that's pending.
Third-degree arson?
I'm sorry?
Third-degree arson.
Well, arson generally. Arson can come up. I mean, it doesn't have to be limited to the Delaware statute. It can be an arson case in general.
It's an unusual crime.
It is an unusual crime. I grant that.
This argument you've been making, is this in your brief?
It is, Your Honor. I certainly hope.
Brief, or I'm just looking at your summary of argument. You said Brown has failed to clearly show, as he must, to secure successive collateral relief, that his arson conviction does not constitute generic arson.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's fine. The clearly show is fine, but do you really argue that there has to be a case?
I do, Your Honor. I'm not finding the page, but I know that it's in the brief. The first argument was based on the idea that there are sentencing claims that can be brought, and we're not disputing that. It's on pages, I believe, Your Honor, it's pages, it starts on page 30. It's titled The Requirements for Successive Collateral Relief, and it spans a few pages thereafter, up to page 33. So, yes, I do believe that we've preserved that argument, and it's an argument that we have made in other cases before, but it has never sort of gained traction, and I think this case sort of squarely illustrates the prudential benefits of that kind of a rule. Yes, Your Honor.
I appreciate your position on 2241, but I just want to call your attention to your reference to Whaley in
yes.
the brief. And in the brief, the government brief, you say the court held that a Missouri statute prescribing the act of knowingly burning or exploding .. by
right.
starting a fire.
Right.
And then you say required of mental state. Now you quote again, comparable to malicious.
Right.
I'm sure it may well have been just an oversight, but absent from that quote
yes.
is when the Missouri law,
right, the second half.
Which speaks a person commits a crime of knowingly burning or exploding when he knowingly damages the property of another.
Right.
Now that's exactly the type of mens rea requirement that's absent from the Delaware statute.
I appreciate that.
So I just
that.
Suggest that that's not quite the mirror image or...
No, I appreciate that. And if I may, I would just... I know I've far exceeded my time, but if I just, as a matter of personal prerogative, Your Honor,
yeah.
I take my obligations as an officer of a court very seriously. I have never misled a court, and I never will, and I never would. I can appreciate, in light of their reply brief and the fact that we omitted that language, that the better practice would have been for me to include it all, and I certainly regret that. But I do want to emphasize, the reason it was left out was not in any way to try to mislead the court. In our view, and I understand that reasonable minds perhaps can debate it, we were focused on the fact that it was really a response to their point that common law arson requires malicious burning. And all the point that we were trying to illustrate was that modern state statutes that cover intentional or knowing burning is sufficient to satisfy the maliciousness element. I understand in hindsight now what the better practice would have been, but I want to assure the court there was no effort to be...
No, I'm not making the charge, I guess. I'm just,
I understand
just
that
underscoring the need to be... pretty careful.
I appreciate that.
Because it creates a little bit of a fissure in your argument.
I
didn't need to be there.
I appreciate all those sentiments, Your Honor. Thank you. I appreciate.
You say you preserved this issue. You did in a sense, but not in the sense in which you articulated it in your argument. What you did was you said, and if this notion there should be previous recognition of the rule, you rely on a 2255 case. And then you say, well, that should, I'm looking at page 32, you
right.
say you admit Brown's case is different.
Right.
And then you say, nevertheless, the stringent limitations on the availability of successive section 2255 release imposed by Congress.
Yes.
And recognized in Tyler, inform
right.
the availability. That's pretty weak, right?
Well, I certainly can't take the position that Tyler can...
Statutory language is different, right?
It is, but what the relevance of Tyler...
You don't actually cite anything. I mean, you're so insistent that it has to be a precedent for successive relief, but you have no precedent for your position that there has to have been a... authoritative decision.
No, and I didn't claim that Tyler was authoritative, but I thought it illustrates the point. And as we discussed before, 2241 law is very much judge-made in terms of interpreting inadequate or ineffective. And we just think that the court, as I said in the brief, I used the word inform. I think that Congress's intent how to streamline and limit second or successives can certainly inform. This is a successive application. It's just brought under a different provision because 2255 is inadequate. So we don't have any cases. I'm not contending. I didn't mean to suggest there's any precedent out there. I think Tyler does help to support that rule, and I think as a matter of common sense, the idea of trying to limit successive relief 15 years after the judgment, it should be stringent. I mean, first 2255 is more restrictive than direct appeal, and second 2255 is more restrictive than that. And as we move further down the line, the heightened finality interests that are at stake, I think, justify a kind of stringent understanding.
Okay,
so
I'm sorry.
Just so I'm absolutely clear the government's position. So, Mr. Rucker, would your position be the absence of precedent would preclude reliance on a new, if that be the right word, interpretation of a statute under 2241? Is that what you're seeking this circuit to say in an opinion?
Let me try to answer the question this way because I'm not sure I completely follow. Let's just put it this way. If the prior conviction in this case were a DUI or a failure to report escape, there wouldn't be any argument because there would be a binding precedent that would control. But in the Begay and Chambers setting as to sentencing enhancements, there's an extra layer involved, if you will, because the principles are going to apply beyond just DUI and failure to report escape.
Right.
And so in the 11th Circuit case in Gilbert, for example, I think illustrates how this procedure can work. In Gilbert, he received a sentence enhancement under 1996 Circuit precedent for carrying a concealed firearm. And then Begay came down. And then the 11th Circuit, after Begay, squarely reconsidered its own precedent. And the 11th Circuit said, that precedent is wrong. It's no longer good law. It's been abrogated. So then you have a prisoner like Mr. Gilbert. He got the sentencing enhancement for carrying a concealed firearm. He could then point to precedent that was applicable that demonstrated that he was wrongly sentenced. He didn't have to rely just on Begay. He had a circuit interpretation of it.
No, but what's so silly about that? Suppose you've conceded, as you ought to, that there's no functional difference between the DUI and this third-degree arson. Then you'd say, well, I agree, there's no functional difference, but there's no precedent with regard to the arson,
right,
for the obvious reason that it's such an absurd law, right? And no cases. So what do you accomplish by that?
Well,
it's
arbitrary. I think what we're trying to accomplish is focus not just on this case, but on the broader subset. These 2241 habeas petitions are spiraling. There are significant numbers of them that are being filed throughout the courts of the country, particularly in the wake of Begay and Chambers. And it's a tremendous drain on prosecutorial and judicial resources. And what we're trying to do is make sure that people who are seeking this relief have a strong, credible basis 15 years after the judgment to come back in.
Well, that's why I understand when you say in your summary of argument that the person seeking successive relief has to make a clear showing.
Right.
You can make that as emphatic as you want, but to insist there always has to be a decision.
Well,
when the more ridiculous the government's position is, the less likely there is to be a precedent because no one would have thought of this before.
Just to be clear, I think the government would be satisfied with a rule that says it has to be clear.
Okay.
I mean, if it doesn't,
that's a good place to stop.
But the best way, I think the most logical way to make it clear is through a precedent.
No, that is a way.
A way. I would concede that. Yes,
it is a way. Okay, good. So we're in agreement.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Mr. I appreciate the court's indulgence. Thank you.
You've been very patient with us.
I appreciate it.
So, Mr. Unikowski, do you have anything further?
Just very briefly, Your Honor. Your Honor, we'd just like to make two very, very quick points. First of all, I think that the government's position in its presentation that there has to be a clear precedent on a point is not consistent.
Okay, if he's abandoned it, okay.
Well, in that event, I will I'll move on, Your Honor. The government contends that we don't have any precedent whatsoever regarding what generic arson means, and we do quote Begay. We certainly acknowledge that it's not the holding of Begay. It's a dictum of Begay of what arson means, but we certainly think it's a very strong dictum that certainly clarifies the court's holding considerably. And so we do think that it would be appropriate for this court to follow that strong dictum, even if it's not actually the precise holding of the court.
Well, it's the whole foundation of the purposeful, violent, and aggressive requirement.
Right. That is our view, and it's true that the court was not actually construing arson, but it's almost as close as you can get to a holding of what arson is in our view. And just the last point very rapidly I'd like to make is we do think there's a certain incongruity, which we point out in our reply brief on page 18, saying that, you know, even if this is less serious, objectively less serious than arson, which is an enumerated offense, it would still fall within the residual clause. In Sykes, the court said that you have to compare the offense to the most analogous offense, and clearly this is, you know, this arson in the third degree is less serious than the enumerated offense, and as we explain in our reply brief, we think this is an additional reason it doesn't qualify as a sentencing enhancement. And if the court has no further questions, we would ask the court to reverse judgment below.
Okay, thanks. Thanks very much, Mr. Yunkai. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, sir.
So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Mr. Rutger as well for his efforts for the government.